Very good. Jack, how are you this morning?
Hi, John. Good.
Real quick, I'm a big fan of the book. For our audience who is not aware of it, Tunney, boxing's brainiest champ in the upset of the great Jack Dempsey, which recently has just come out in paperback, which is wonderful for stocking stuffers, Hanukkah, Kwanzaa, whichever your holiday may be. You actually signed this book to me back in May of this year. And says to John, best of luck with Fighting Fitness USA, Jack.
Oh, where was this, John?
This was at RJ Julian Madison.
Oh, yes.
And it was a great signing. I was just thrilled to meet with you. We spoke briefly. You had other folks to talk with.
That was a great night.
Oh, outstanding. One of the things I wanted to talk to you about, on paper, Gene Tunney looks as if he should have been arguably the most popular heavyweight champion in our day. He was articulate, he was athletic, he was good-looking, he was a legitimate war hero in a time when Jack Dempsey was absolutely covering up, running away from, call it what you may, the draft-dodging issue. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, it's an interesting point you bring up. If Gene Tunney were around today, he not only would be immensely popular, he'd be on the cover of Time and Newsweek and probably maybe even U.S. News and the World Report, not to mention Sports Illustrated
and GQ.
ESPN, the magazine. He would be idolized because of the characteristics you mentioned. But, you know, it was a different era. It was an era when here was a guy who was a masterful boxer at a time when top-flight heavyweights were supposed to, possess knockout power like Dempsey did, and he was aloof. And he was aloof from the media, and he was aloof from people, for the most part, in the boxing establishment. And this practically made him a pariah. But times have changed. If he was around today, given the behavior of a lot of the professional athletes of today, the misbehavior, I should say, someone like him, you know, clean-cut, good-looking, articulate, all the characteristics you mentioned, I think would have made him idolized.
Well, you know, it's a great point, and one of the things that I've noticed in a lot of my readings regarding Tunney and Dempsey is I think a lot has to do with, as you just mentioned, this is the time period. I think the Roaring Twenties were exactly that. They were a roaring, rough-and-tumble age, and I think that a Gene Tunney perhaps was a little premature in his error. Certainly, you know, he sets up the exact ideal that you would think. Do you think that to a certain degree he turned his back on the boxing fraternity, and do you think that has hurt him historically?
Well, he did. He didn't so much as turn his back on it when he retired. He walked away from it, and he, as he told me in a memorable meeting I had with him on the train, the only time I ever met him, you know, it was incredible. I was coming back, young reporter, just in New York, started working in New York in the 60s, And I'm on a commuter train, and the introduction covers that quite a bit. That's how the book starts. And I met him, and I heard this guy was aloof, you know, and elitist and so on, and not too friendly with unless he knew you well. And he started a conversation with me. And I turned around, and I saw this good-looking man in his 60s, nearing 70, the briefcase, a pinstripe suit, like any other community, reading the paper. I mean, can you imagine a former heavyweight champion of the world who made millions in the ring at a time when 1 million was 20 million today, riding the commuter train? That was him. He was a businessman. He wasn't a fighter anymore. And he told me how when he didn't so much walk away as he figured that part of his life was over. Now he wanted to become a businessman, eminently successful. I mean, CEOs of two companies on like 12 boards of directors, you know, went to the opera, to the theater. And when he was invited to major fights, including one where they were paying all his expenses for him and his wife to go to Sweden for the second Johansson-Patterson fight, and he turned it down. He said, you know, I just don't want to do it. He says, what's the point of me getting in the ring and being introduced? He didn't understand that people like to see the old champs in the ring. He didn't understand that. He said, why should I take attention away from the fighters who are going to be fighting in the main event? And that only made him more disliked by the media. As he said to me on the train, he said, you know, I haven't fought in 30 years, or 30 years. And he said they probably dislike me more now than they did when I was fighting. But he was his own man, and he enjoyed watching boxing, and I asked him the question I had to inevitably, who do you like to watch? You don't go to many fights, certainly. Matter of fact, the only time I saw him at a fight, he was at the first Ali Frazier fight at Madison Square Garden, the first big fight I covered. And he sat at ringside, and who was he sitting alongside but Jack Dempsey, who became one of his best friends. They bonded together. It's a wonderful part of the book at the end. Two guys who went at each other, you know, trying to knock each other out, and they became very close friends, getting together after work for a drink, you know. And he and his wife, the beautiful heiress from Greenwich, Polly Lauder, who he fell in love with and married, they'd go to Dempsey's restaurant, and they'd sit with Jack, and that was him. It was a different time and a different time period, and he wanted to get on with his life in a different a different dimension.
You know, Jack, what you were describing about meeting Tunney on the train is such a wonderful opening in your book. It's a great way to thrust you into your interaction with this man. We should probably tell the listeners about, I guess it's, correct me if I'm wrong, the two amazing fights that happened, I guess in the year 1926, correct me if I'm wrong, where he did beat Dempsey.
Right.
And one of the things that Tunney has become infamous now for is the long count. So maybe we'll bring up that old saw. And if you could explain that and why Tunney has this gigantic place in boxing literature, that would be great.
Interesting you mention that, Benny, because unfortunately, in addition to being kind of forgotten, and one of the reasons why I wrote the book, he also, when he's remembered, it's in a negative sense. It's in a negative sense. Oh, he's the guy. I heard about this from the time I was a little kid. I grew up in Stanford, and he lived in North Stanford on his magnificent estate, 200 acres. His widow, who just turned 100 this past April and still is alert and as sharp as can be and a lovely lady, still lives there on the estate on Erskine Road in Stanford. And Tunney and the family, as a matter of fact, the sons come up to visit her almost every week, two of the sons. Anyway, he's remembered for the long count in a negative sense. The sense seems to be the remembrance of that fight, and it's probably the most famous fight of all time, with all due respect to the third Frazier-Ali fight, because it was most controversial. The seventh round, when the long count occurred, is without a doubt, the most memorable round in boxing history. And he's remembered as a guy who was down for 16, 17 seconds, and the referee gave him this big break, you know, and wanted Tunney Dempsey to win the fight, and therefore didn't start counting until it was late. It was late. He gave him another 5 or 6 seconds. Totally wrong. But because the referee, Dempsey, as you recall, what happened there, the rules had been changed several years earlier where a fighter scoring a knockdown had to go to the farthest neutral corner. Dempsey grew up, it was the old school. When you knocked a guy down, you stood right over him, and you get up and you hit him and knocked him right down again. It's hard to believe that that actually happened, but that was the way it was. Now, in the heat of battle, 140,000 people, 145,000 people, the biggest crowd ever to watch a fight anywhere in the world. And he, in the heat of battle, he forgets the new rule, and he stays right over Tunney in the corner, the closest corner. And the referee is waving him to neutral corner. And finally, of course, he goes. By then, 5 or 6, 7 seconds have elapsed. But yet the myth is that Dempsey got cheated out of regaining his title. And that's how Tunney was kind of he's the guy. You mentioned Tunney. Oh, he's the guy who, Dempsey got cheated out of knocking him out because he knocked him out, but still didn't win the fight because the referee gave Tunney a break.
So there was nothing that Tunney did wrong in that instance. It was sort of a weird phenomenon of nature. The ref is just trying to get Dempsey back into his corner. There's a few extra seconds.
There was. And you recall what happened. The referee, Dave Barry, before the fight, he told both fighters at center ring, remember the rule, he said. And each of you scores a knockdown, you go to the farthest neutral corner. Do you understand that, Gene? Yes. Do you understand that, Jack? Dempsey said yes. but in the heat of battle, he forgot about it. And the referee acted in accordance with the rules. He did the right thing. Sure, he gave Tunney a break. Maybe Tunney wouldn't have got up at the count of 10 if he started counting immediately, but he couldn't. He couldn't under the Illinois rules, and they were the same in New York at that time. They also had been changed in New York a couple of years earlier. He did the right thing. It wasn't until Dempsey went to the farthest neutral corner that he began the count. Matter of fact, one of the most famous pictures, and I think it's in the book, is of Dempsey standing in the corner practically right over Tunney, waiting for him to get up, and he's going to belt him and knock him down again and probably knock him out for good.
I think a funny historical side note to that is what very few people realize is the fact that Dempsey agreed to this rule change. From what I understand, Tunney was nonplussed by it. He didn't care one way or the other. This is something that Dempsey, you know, insisted being in during that fight. And when asked about the infamous long count, Tunney, by and large, would say, well, you know what? I don't really remember much of it. If you look at the footage, Dempsey hits me with 7 shots. I don't remember anything after the second. He said, right. I looked up. The ref had not reached 10. I stood up. I had no idea how much time had elapsed. I had no idea where Dempsey was. And, you know, because of that, historically, again, he has been, you're right, he's been vilified. And he put on two fantastic, fantastic fights against Dempsey. He beat him handily the first time. And the second time, it looked like he was on his way to beat him the second time as well, were it not for that one combination in the 7th round.
Exactly. When you look at it, the first 10 rounds in Philadelphia, the first fight, when Tunney was given virtually no chance. After all, he's basically light heavyweight, giving away some weight. He's growing into a heavyweight, put on some weight, but given no chance against Dempsey, the Manassas Mauler, your knockout artist. Tunney's strictly a boxer. Tunney wins all 10 rounds. All 10 rounds. He wins the fight, wins all 10 rounds. It's a mismatch. Everybody says it's going to be a mismatch because Dempsey is going to beat up on Tunney. Well, it was a mismatch. It was a mismatch because Dempsey could hardly touch Tunney. In the second fight of the 10 rounds, it's generally conceded that Tunney won 9 of the 10. The only round he lost was the 7th round when he got knocked down. You made the point, John, about how the Dempsey people went to the Illinois State Athletic Commission and met with him a day or two before the fight and said, look, hey, remember this rule about if a fighter scores a knockdown, they've got to go to the farthest neutral corner. Apparently they were concerned, and Dempsey really was. Dempsey never had a whole lot of confidence, hard to believe, considering all the knockouts he scored. But he wasn't the most confident guy in the world. And that's why he wanted to end the fight as quickly as he could, because he always felt if the fight went beyond the first or second round, he might lose. But they thought, Dempsey was worried. He knew Tunney had beaten him badly in the first fight. He was afraid he might knock him down in the second fight. That's why they went to the commission and said, hey, we want to make sure the referee enforces this rule, which is ironic.
Well, you know, the other funny thing was, and that's where Jack Dempsey coined the famous phrase, you know, when asked about his defeat to Tunney, to his wife Estelle Taylor, she said, what happened, Ginsburg? And he said, honey, I forgot to duck.
That's right. It's one of the great quotes in boxing, in history. One of the other great quote out of the book, to show you how civil these guys were back in those days, athletes were totally different. Sure, in baseball you had the Ty Cobbs who were, you know, crazy and wild and nasty, you know. But in boxing, for the most part, these guys were very civil when they fought each other. There's no trash talking at the weigh-in, right, and scream at each other when the fights were announced at a press conference. You didn't have that. And these two guys had great respect for each other, so much so that after the first fight, one of the sports writers said to Tunney, he said, you know, you guys in the 5th round, you were talking to each other briefly. What'd you say? And Tunney said, well, you know, Jack has a tendency to hit that left hook to the body, and sometimes it goes a little below the belt. And he hit me a couple shots, and the referee didn't call it. And so I said to him, keep him up, Jack. And then another writer said, what did Dempsey say? And Dempsey said, sorry, Gene.
Can
you imagine two fighters today exchanging that kind of dialogue?
Well, you know, it's definitely I think Gene Tunney epitomized the gentleman boxer. I do a lot of coaching certification programs for USA Boxing, which is the United States Olympic team's, you know, amateur governing body. And, you know, one of the things that we try to tell our coaches is the fact that, you know, boxing is a wonderful sport if you teach the corresponding life skills that go with it. And you look at some of the fighters that possess that, and certainly more in this day and age, there's quite a few more who don't. But you look at Gene Tunney, and Gene Tunney took boxing, used it as a vehicle, was incredibly successful. Probably the only one that we have to compare him to in this day and age would maybe be an Oscar De La Hoya.
I think that's a good comparison, and yet his zest for learning, his reading of Shakespeare and other classics, his friendships which developed with George Bernard Shaw and Thornton Wilder and Somerset Maugham, while he was still fighting, no less. This made him all the more disliked by the media. You weren't supposed to be hanging around with writers like that when you were a fighter. And ironically, you had some brilliant writers at that era. If the Roaring Twenties was the golden age of sport, which I think it may well have been, and it was also the golden age of sports writing, you had people like Grantlin Rice, to this day looked upon by many sports writers as the greatest sports writer of all time. Ring Lardner, Damon Runyon. I mean, those are pretty big names.
Absolutely.
These guys did not like Tunney. They didn't like him. Now, they were all well-educated. They were smart. They were brilliant writers. Yet they didn't like this guy because they thought he was a phony highbrow, a literary poser. He'd come to a press conference after workout and he'd carry a copy of Human Bondage by Somerset Maugham, you know, and they thought he was flaunting this. He didn't read these books, and they really let him have it. But he would never say, hey, I really read these books. He was too proud. He said, if they think I'm a phony, let them think that. That was his way. He was his own man. Later years, ironically, people like Runyon and Rice and some of the others, Paul Gallico, the great sports columnist for the Daily News, became friends of his, had lunch and dinner with him. And he was not get involved in any vendetta with him. He felt that he was a little headstrong when he was a fighter, and he became friendly with a lot of those writers. They realized this guy was really, we missed the story. He really was on the level. He was reading these books, and he is smart, and he's intelligent. And we missed the real good story.
Jack, you know, it's almost like psychologically we need the fighter to be some kind of archetypal beast. And somehow Tunney just doesn't fit that. You know, I have an affinity for him, and I think John does too, because John and I both tend to be a little on the cerebral side. And we're both writers, and I'm trying to work on a book about boxing right now. I wanted to ask you how you got involved in working on this book and how long it took to write, and how was it to find the sources? You know, did you have to travel around and interview tons of people? What's the process been like for you?
Good question, Betty. I never had any intention of writing a book about Gene Tunney. When I met him on the train, hey, I was just starting out in the newspaper business. I wasn't thinking about writing any books, you know, and never gave it a thought. And I knew, even when I met him, I knew this guy, how can this man so forgotten? He rides on the train, nobody pays attention to him. Well, I think everybody in that car, the other commuters, knew him, but they gave him his space. They left him alone. You imagine a former heavyweight champion of the world or any multi-million-dollar athlete riding on a train. He'd be riding in limos. You got guys who bat 250 in baseball riding limos. And Tunney could afford to ride in limo, but he didn't want to. He commuted with a lot of other people from Stanford, met him at the train station, sat in the car with him, talked to him, and then read the paper. But how it all happened, like with a lot of writers, is strictly by happenstance. I happened to have covered a fight at the Mohegan Sun between Zab Judah, a welterweight, a couple of years ago, 5 years ago, and the referee was Arthur McCanny, the legendary Hall of Fame referee, who was already 80 years old. And the fight started about midnight, and I thought, an 80-year-old referee refereeing a fight at midnight, this is kind of really funny. So I pitched the idea of a story to the sports editor at the time at the New York Times, Neil Amder. I asked if we'd done anything on McCanny, and they said, no, not really. I said, you know, he's a colorful guy, he's got a great career. I went out to his house, interviewed him. While I was interviewing him, he started talking about how during World War II, he got recruited by Gene Tunney, who was the head of the Navy's physical fitness program. He was appointed by none other than Franklin Roosevelt. And what happened is Tunney recruited a lot of fighters, a lot of trainers, a lot of other athletes, and had a great group of people, and they all became like chief petty officers in the Navy or whatever. And we're talking about him, and I said to him, I said, you know, Arthur, it's interesting you're talking about Tunney. I said, this is a guy that's totally forgotten. He says, yeah, he is. It's amazing. I said, you know, I'm aware of at least five or six or more books on Dempsey, and McCanny said, you know, there are probably about a dozen. And I said, I've never seen one on Gene Tunney. And he agreed. He said, you know, and he is probably a more interesting guy than Jack Dempsey. I said, you really think so? He said, absolutely. He's married. He fell in love with a beautiful heiress and so on. So that's how it all started. So I went home, went on the Internet looking for books by Gene Tunney, and found about 12 by Dempsey, and also found two by Gene Tunney, two about Gene Tunney. Both written by, guess who, Gene Tunney. He wrote a book in 1930 called A Man Must Fight, and he wrote a book in 1941 when he went into the Navy, a lot of it about going into the Navy and running the Navy's fitness program, and that was the second book. Both out of print. I got copies of both. You can get them if you look hard. I got them from relatives of Tunney. And I have no reason to disbelieve that he didn't write those books, because it sounded like him, and he was literate. He'd read so much. I believe he wrote those books. So anyway, then I called the New York Public Library, found out how many books they had on Gene Tunney. None. Dempsey, 13 or 14. Incredible.
Wow.
So the wheels really were spinning. I went on the Internet and dug up a lot of material about Tunney, old magazine articles and so on, and we ran away, and I called my agent, and he thought that was a great idea, and I did spend months working up a proposal, and we went to the top five major publishers in New York, including Random House, which is the biggest of them all, and within 5 days, Random House, we made a deal with Random House. They loved the idea.
All
happened, if I hadn't been at that Mohegan Sun fight on a Saturday night about 5 years ago with Arthur McCanny in the ring, I never would have done the interview. I never would have written a book. That's
it's interesting. I think in life, there are some, there's some stones in life that are left unturned, clearly, in a lifetime.
Right.
And then there are some that you pick up that I call the weird stones.
Exactly. And to answer your question about, it wasn't easy writing about somebody who fought way back in the 20s and even before that, during the World War One era, and because most of his contemporaries who fought were gone. They
right.
were all gone, including Dempsey.
Absolutely.
And so the first thing I did, I put an ad in, my friend Bert Sugar suggested I do this, put an ad in Ring Magazine, and a lot of old-timers, especially Ring Magazine, which not the same as it was, kind of fallen on hard times.
Exactly.
And in the ad, I said, a quarter-page ad, I said, anybody here seen Tunney? That was my headline, and a picture of Tunney, this good-looking guy in boxing trunks and so on. And I said, Jack Cavanaugh writing a book for Random House about Gene Tunney, da-da-da, and would welcome any memorabilia or anybody who ever saw him fight or knew him, da-da-da, have any material. The response was absolutely incredible. I must have heard from 50 people around the country, including an actor, J.J. Johnson, in Los Angeles. It was on Broadway stage, co-starred with Robert De Niro. There was this cult of Tunney followers out there who saved a lot of material. They sent me photographs, articles. I couldn't believe it. I thought this guy was completely forgotten. And you wouldn't believe the amount of material I got, which helped me tremendously. And then I interviewed some of them, and one was even a pastor of a Catholic church outside of Chicago, who was in his 50s. These weren't just old-timers.
Right.
And he had great admiration for Tunney, read everything he could find about him, which wasn't a whole lot.
That, that brings up a really good point. You know, boxing fans have phenomenal memories. And I think what makes their memories so vivid, as it were, is they, not necessarily the fights, but the fights are important, but I think they associate a period of time in these fights when they were held. I think, is it fair to say that every great champion needs a nemesis? Ali had Frazier, Tunney had Dempsey, Ray Robinson had Jake LaMotta. Is it fair to say that in this day and age, in our era right now, the reason boxing has, along with Ring Magazine, fallen on hard times is there isn't any of that? There are no foils to these fighters these days.
Exactly, I agree. And during the last golden age of boxing, which I covered extensively, was the 1980s, 70s and 80s. And you had Ali on the way out at that time. Larry Holmes covered a lot of his fights with heavyweight champion. You had people like Marvin Hagler. Marvin Hagler had Tommy Hearns. as a nemesis, and so did Sugar Ray Leonard,
exactly.
And Tommy Hearns also.
Yeah.
You had fighters like Roberto Duran. You had the Alexis Arguello. We had so many great fighters. That was the last golden era, and I thought of fighters. But in almost every instance, they had a nemesis. Like you mentioned, obviously, Ali had Frazier, and Lewis in two fights had Schmeling. Going back then,
absolutely.
You had Dempsey and Tunney, exactly. And when you first of all, I think the thing you need in boxing has always been more popular and successful when there's been a great heavyweight champion,
right.
A great heavyweight champion. That boxing went through a doldrums period in the '30s until Joe Louis came along and electrified the first black. Heavyweight champion since Jack Johnson many
yes.
years. Very popular fighter. Both blacks and whites love Joe Louis. And Louis had Schmeling. And there's been other cases like that. Today, there are no rivalries out there. There really aren't any. Promoters try to build them up, but they don't really exist.
Case in point.
I couldn't agree more. Yeah. I don't even know who the heavyweight champions are at this point.
I think there are four of them.
There's four or five of them. That it leads to a good point. There was a tremendous amount of hype about Oscar De La Hoya and Floyd Mayweather.
Right.
HBO did extensive research, the 24/7 thing. And everyone asked me about that. And Jack and I said, well, I got to tell you, I have a hard time believing the hype. I think this is a promotion because I will tell you that I can't look across a ring from a guy and know that in 45 minutes I'm going to make him a multi-millionaire and have very many hard feelings towards him. We have to kind of be in this together. Just to kind of confirm that, in the New Haven Register, there was a quote by Antonio Tarver, who used to be the former light heavyweight champion
right.
of the world. And right now they've been trying to put together a New Haven local fighter, Chad Dawson, and Antonio Tarver. And Antonio Tarver said, point blank, I will not put a dime in this kid's pocket. I'll wait till he gets old. And I think that is real indicative of how the business of boxing has overtaken the passion of boxing.
It has. And I think that was a contrived kind of rivalry you mentioned between Mayweather and De La Hoya. It didn't really exist. And I think you need that. And you need a popular heavyweight champion. There are four of them. I love my friend Bert Sugar's line. I think I used it in my book when he said you can take the four heavyweight champions of the world and put them in their boxing trunks, their boxing, their shoes, their robes, their championship belts, and put them in a police lineup. And not only would nobody know who they were, but nobody would even know what they did for a living.
Bert Sugar is hysterical.
I think that's a typical Sugar line, right?
Absolutely.
Obviously Bert has a vested interest in boxing, and goes to all the fights, but he came up with that line. Even he admits that the sport is kind of in the doldrums, to say the least. But another point that Dempsey, I think Tunney, was disliked, you got to remember, as I said in the book, he's the first heavyweight champion ever to win a heavyweight title by decision. You just didn't do that. Even later, Ali, Marciano, Lewis, you name them, whoever was the heavyweight champion of the world, George Foreman, any of them, all won their titles by knockouts. And going back before that, going back into the 1800s, 1700s, every heavyweight championship, when it changed hands, was always by knockout. Here's a light heavyweight, Tunney, a boxer, master boxer. He wins it by decision. Well, that was supposed to happen among heavyweights. That's okay among lightweight fighters. That was another reason why he was maligned and disliked.
Well, I think the explosion, the explosiveness of heavyweight boxing has always been there. I think you're right. For example, when Joe Louis basically, in Joe Louis's own words to Billy Conn, were, look, I lent you kid the title for 12 rounds, you didn't know what to do with it. But Joe Louis fought a blown-up heavyweight in the form of Billy Conn. That fight was arguably going to go the distance until, Louis just put the kibosh on that by knocking him out in the 13th. But
exactly, in the first fight, and then knocked him out even easier
quickly in the second.
In the second fight, and But again, I think you do. You do need the rivalries. And Dempsey had Tunney and vice versa. Ali had Frazier. And Lewis had Schmeling, even for only two. Well, two fights. Two, of course, was Dempsey and Tunney also two fights. But the rivalry, those great rivalries are necessary, I think, in boxing, in any weight class. And as I said, you go back in the 80s, look at Duran and the great rivalry, Duran and Sugar Ray Leonard.
Absolutely.
The two memorable fights.
Absolutely.
Second of which I covered the Nomas fight in New Orleans. But there again, there was a great rivalry between the two of those guys, although they only fought two times.
Can I share with you a Bert Sugar story? I was in Canastota, New York this summer when Roberto Duran was inducted into the Boxing Hall of Fame. And I ran into Bert, and he and I have talked. He probably knows me by sight, not by name. And I said, how is Roberto? Because he's kind of standoffish to everybody. And Bert said, you know, there's two things. He said, first of all, Roberto's English is not that great. And secondly, every time he comes over to the country, he is living down the infamous no mas, no mas thing. I said, well, Bert, if the shoe fits. And he said, yeah, but he never said no mas, no mas. I said, how do you know that? He said, I covered the fight. He said, I was ringside. I heard it. He didn't say no mas, no mas. I said, where'd that come from? He said, Howard Cosell. And he said, the rest is history.
Oh, really?
Yep.
Well, it's interesting because Bert's book is out now on Angelo Dundee. I don't know whether you've seen it.
Not yet.
And the book is out. It was reviewed, as a matter of fact, got a very favorable review in the New York Times this past Sunday. And in the book, I haven't read it, but I've heard that in the book, Angelo Dundee, who, of course, was in Sugar Ray's corner, specifically comes out and say, I don't know how he knows this because he was across the ring.
Across the room, right.
He said that Duran never said that. And funny thing about Duran, by the way, about his English. I remember he was going to fight, I think, Davey Moore.
Yep.
At the Garden, and he was pretty much over the hill, and nobody gave him a chance, and of course he knocked out Davey Moore, and he was training up at the Playboy Club in Great Gorge, in New Jersey, and I went up to. And I'd covered a lot of his fights, and I got to know him. And I was, and during the press conference, he's just speaking Spanish, and the translator for him, and asked questions in English, like, and he'd shake his head, like, can't you answer that in English, Roberto? And broadcast people want to get something they could use on the air, and he'd shake his head. And after the press conference, I went over to him and I said, good luck, Roberto, in your fight. He says, thank you very much for coming. He says, I'll see you that night. In perfect English.
But, hey, Jack, I think you can tell that we could go on with you forever. And I know for sure, since it's about 11:05, that you said you needed to get going to teach your writing class
at Fairfield U.
Can I propose a rematch for the three of us?
Oh, sure. I'd be glad to do it, Benny.
Because we would love to talk to you more. I mean, it feels like we could just go on,
Jack,
and on.
Jack, we can talk all day easily.
And so we've been talking with Jack Kavanaugh, veteran sports writer and author of a great new book, Boxing Tunney, Boxing's Brainiest Champ and His Upset of the Great Jack Dempsey, which Sports Illustrated has called a long overdue portrait of a fascinating fighter. Jack, it's been fantastic. And John, final point.
Jack, one more thing I want you to think about before we talk again. The two most uninteresting heavyweights in the history of the sport, I'm going to give you my two, and then you can let me know. Jess Willard, Primo Carnera.
That's a good point. I think at least most of Jess's fights are on the level, whereas practically none of Primo's were. Primo, of course, was controlled by the mob. I think Bud Schilberg's wonderful book, The Heart of the Fall, made into a movie with Humphrey Bogart.
Absolutely.
Bogart ever made.
That's right.
Great movie with Rod Steiger, a classic movie. I think one of the best boxing movies, but somehow overlooked. Great boxing movie about Carnera's career.
Absolutely.
About how the mob controlled him and almost every one of his fights was fixed until he went for the end of the title fight against Max Baer, and that one was on the level, and Baer just destroyed
him. All of a sudden, Primo was like, wait a second, how come he's not going down?
Absolutely. And Primo, being Primo, really thought he was knocking these people out.
Absolutely.
In almost every instance. In the case of a couple guys didn't get down when they were supposed to, and they got roughed up, know, later on after the fight.
The fight afterward was much harder than the fight during the ring, for sure.
Exactly.
That brings
hey,
up a possible...
It's been nice being with you, Benny and
John. Yes, it's been wonderful. And another possible future topic could be boxing as portrayed in the movies. Thank you so much, Jack. Hope to talk to you soon.
You're welcome.
Take care.
Nice to be with you.
Nice talking to you.
Jack, take care.
So... there we have it, and stay tuned. By the way, we are WPKN 89.5 FM Bridgeport and WPKM 88.7 FM Montauk. And as a special treat, and I hope that Jack will be listening to the radio as he gets ready to go to his teaching job, teaching writing. And John, you'll stick around for a few minutes and listen to this.
That I was hit seven times in succession in the seventh round in my contest with Jack Dempsey for the World's Heavyweight Championship was one of my luckiest nights. As a matter of fact, the luckiest night of my life. Yes, I was down. I heard the referee count two. I knew I had to get up, which was part of my professional obligation. But what to do when I got up was the important thing. I decided to stay away from Jack. And it was a very wise decision, as the results show.
Well, my thoughts was and hoping he would never get up, but unfortunately he did, and won the fight, and more power to him. A great boy and a great champion.
So a little bit of history.
There it is.
Well, I do hope we get to talk with Jack Kavanaugh again.
Oh, absolutely compelling writer. He has covered the sport inside and out. Fantastic time talking to him today.
Yeah, terrific. And so what's next for us, John? Future interviews, ideas? We're going to bring some boxers into the studio again?
I think I'd like to bring in some professionals, and I'd like to kind of get a perspective from that. I think thus far you and I have talked a great deal about everything. I mean, MMA, female boxers. We've talked about the amateur programs. I think it's time we get some professional perspective.
I'm ready.
Let's do it.
Okay, thanks again. Been talking with John Spehar of Fighting Fitness. And we're going to go back to music. It is about 10 after 11. My name's Binnie. I'm here on Thursdays from 10 a.m. until noon.